No one wants to manage databases if they can avoid it. That's why MongoDB made MongoDB Atlas, a global cloud database service that runs on AWS, GCP, and Azure. You can deploy a fully managed MongoDB database in minutes with just a few clicks or a few API calls. MongoDB Atlas automates deployment, automates updates, handles scaling, and more so that you can focus on your application instead of taking care of your database. You can get started free at mongodb.com/atlas. Now, if you're already managing a MongoDB deployment, Atlas has a live migration service, so you can migrate it easily with minimal downtime and then get back to what matters. Stop managing your database and start using MongoDB Atlas. Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. Today I'm talking with Danny Wrench. He's an American chess master and the chief chess officer at chess.com. How are you, sir?
Doing good, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So the easy thing to do would be to have a lovely chat with you about how The Queen's Gambit is a great show and everyone loves it and Netflix is wonderful and how everyone's signing up for chess.
You mean that's not why I'm here?
No, I mean, it's great, right? Like, we all agree, it's a perfect season of television. Like, there's all these wonderful, perfect seasons of television that have been happening. You know, The Watchmen, Lovecraft Country, where someone makes a season and they just go, all right, we're done.
Right.
And they just drop the mic and they walk off. Like, I don't want The Queen's Gambit Part 2, you know, castling or whatever, like, Part 2 would be called.
Right.
but I'm seeing lots of excitement about this. But here's the deal. I was watching, I was seeing, I was orbiting, kind of a secondary orbit of chess.com years ago. I think you all have been building community there for years, and it's just that something happened, something in the form of this show. But you've been building community, creating technology for how long has this been going on?
You know, it's a great way to put it. And obviously, I'm going to do the best I can to not answer all the potential ways I could answer that at first. And I'll just say that, so obviously we founded the company it was actually founded in 2005. We launched in 2007. And, you know, we've been building things ever since from, you know, originally it was literally just forums to then a Java supported live chess server where real-time chess games could be played. Then we also have daily chess games where people can play with multiple days per move, which I think a lot of casual people forget and then really like when they find out, like, oh, I don't have to be stressed out about a super fast game. I can have several days to move and send a link to my friend and all that stuff. And then, you know, I would say that it was 2008, 2009, and really 2010 where, you know, my role really started to shape up, which was not just sort of helping support Chess Vision for what would serve with a very fortunate domain name, right? Chess.com. We were very lucky. And the story of which we got that is, you know, the unedited version it's kind of crazy anyway, but we won't get into that right now, but let's just say that we got very lucky with that. We were experiencing a lot of traffic growth, but really 2009, 2010, we started to hit our stride with the content of chess and how we would really create a great model for not just for people to connect and play, which were both free, but the freemium model kicks in. You would upgrade for access to videos or to puzzle trainers or to, you know, lessons, which is premium content. And one of our most popular tools, a combination of you watch a video, and you get follow-up questions, right? So let's say that that kind of model, the freemium model, really kicked in around then. And again, I'll save a lot else for it, for whatever questions you might have to follow up on that, because it kind of blew up, but you mentioned you've been kind of circling and orbiting, and I assume you're kind of talking about our investment into what has become, you know, call it the streaming entertainment portion of chess, right? The Twitch portion of chess, I assume.
Yeah. So, I mean, I work on .NET, which is C#, and we have a mutual friend in the space, and we are looking at, you know, I have been a long time a person who is excited about education and all of the techniques by which one educates.
Right.
And by educating people, I think you need to make a place where they can show up and kind of enjoy each other and enjoy the thing that they share.
Right.
So that place can be a BBS where they dial in with a modem 30 years ago. It could be a PHBB forum. It could be C-SPAN for chess.
Right.
And chess.com/TV is that, because it's always on and there's always a friend playing chess and you can can watch.
And it's literally on right now. And if you went into the chess category on Twitch, there'd be tens of thousands of people watching numerous different channels. Obviously, you think of really popular ones like, you know, the main chess channel, our channel, or Hikaru Nakamura's channel and others. But, you know, I really like the way you said that, because what I would say is one of the things that has been really inspiring and awesome about our investment into streaming chess, right? Creating edutainment, as I like to call it, right? It's educational, but it's entertaining. And it's edutainment in that it brings people together over something they're curious about, something they maybe want to get better at. They don't always feel like they're grinding. And I think one of the things we've learned about, you know, technology, my wife's a teacher, and where classrooms have gone with like the 21st century classroom is teachers are trying to engage a different type of brain than they were 30, 40 years ago, even when you and I were kids, right? Just, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And so that like the gamification of the educational experience is one that you're trying to inspire motivation to learn. And one of the things that Chess TV does is you maybe don't always roll out of bed like, I'm going to go do 2 hours of a chess book or a chess lesson. But you connect with someone who's enjoying and experiencing the same thing you are. You are then maybe re-inspired, re-motivated. We've experienced this bump every couple of years with the World Chess Championship as one of the previous events, or let's say edutaining experiences, where we would do commentary. And often it was a genre crossing moment because people tend to be interested every couple of years of who's going to win the World Championship. And now we have that moment happening kind of on steroids right now with the Queen's Gambit. And we know that not just because chess is trending on Google or because everyone in the world is talking about it. And we have been doing all kinds of interviews with Good Morning America and Today. It's been nuts, right? But really, we're not even here talking about that. We're talking about the fact that we've been establishing this sort of baseline of creating an edutaining experience and inspiring people to learn for a very long time. And then it's allowed us to be in a fortunate position to kind of catch these swan moments, right? You know, frankly, we experienced a swan moment earlier this year that, you know, that we never asked for, unfortunately, with the COVID-19 pandemic and, you know, a lot of online businesses, you know, seeing different types of retention for users. And without getting into all that, that kind of helped. And then, but really the investment that was already made with Twitch kind of helped keep a lot of those newly interested chess enthusiasts online around. Now with Queen's Gambit, we're experiencing that again, right? We have a lot of people who are finding, oh my gosh, this is bigger, better, more interesting, more entertaining than I ever thought it was. And that's been our model forever. One of the things we're super proud of is we're not Clash Royale-ing the experience of how we monetize every possible emote. Our general North Star metric in the company is getting people to ask one question, which is, why did I lose that chess game? Because the moment you ask that is the moment they care. They're like, why did I lose that game? Like, what happened there? What happened, right? And we have that with, you know, our analysis and our lessons. And so, you know, our North Star is getting people inspired to get better. And yeah, so I think you said it well. And it's been the main goal we've had with Twitch and streaming and our investment there over the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, when I think about chess and when I think about playing chess, I think to myself, you know what this needs is in-app purchases. If only I could buy a loot box to really take that queen's bishop to the next level.
No, but it is true. I mean, I'll be honest. I mean, you know, you can imagine in our position, you know, we're completely privately owned. We've never taken VC funding. Eric, my partner and co-founder, he at one point borrowed $70,000 from a friend's mom and we paid it back very early. Like, we are completely profitable and, you know, have been every quarter. And that's not a flex. What I'm saying is like, all those things are true, but people come along looking to acquire us and ask, why don't we do a bunch more of that stuff all the time? And I don't know what the future holds. And obviously we have a massive community and we are running a business, but our goal is not to do that. Our goal is to just like get people to want to get better. Right. And so we invest on the content side as almost chess marketing to inspire people to want to get better. And then every once in a while, something amazing happens that also inspires a bunch of people to want to get better. And we had nothing to do with it, but we're kind of in a cool position to maybe get a lot of new people sticking around forever, wanting to play and get better at chess.
Mm-hmm. One who doesn't care about chess could look at chess.com and all of your success, and they could say, well, you know, they're winning, they're succeeding because they got a great domain name. But that is a simplistic way to look at it, because I think that you are not only creating a really great community for people, but you're creating technology
right
for people to enjoy chess. And I thought naively, like, oh yeah, you know, first comer, first, you know, what is it called? First mover.
First to market. Yeah. First to market
or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was looking at a blog post here. I'm looking at one right now from 2015 by a gentleman named Hikaru, who's a grandmaster. And he's saying he's looking at his path to winning the U.S. championship. And I thought, oh, this will be a lovely bit of prose. And I'm going, prose. He's talking about the championship. And then it's like, oh, here's a screenshot of his chess game. And then I see a little VCR, you know, forward, backwards, play.
Right.
I start clicking around. This little widget is not just a VCR. It's a completely interactive experience embedded. And then I start scrolling. And in fact, his blog post is dozens of these mixed with pictures of what's going on here. But I've also seen interviews where he's not a technical person.
Yeah.
How do you make chess authorship, game replays accessible to the non-technical?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, because that's the other thing we're doing, not just the entertainment side of, you know, whatever the show is, the edutainment side, but also making it easy for people to share, right, chess. Mm-hmm. And like you said, do exactly that. I mean, you know, so the back end of our site is basically supported by multiple different PHP frameworks over the year. We've everything from Symfony to MySQL to Python. I mean, all kinds of stuff that basically help deliver massive, large amounts of data. I mean, just today, we had 7.5 million chess games played, right? That's a rolling 24 hours, right? So we've crossed into the billions, and we had a funny story. We actually made it onto Hacker News a couple of years ago with a big failing where we hit that, what is that magical, like 2.3 billion number where it was actually super funny. And we knew it was coming, and we had already prepared for it on the web and actually Android, but only iOS was, never mind, funny story. But long story short, we're delivering massive amounts of data, right? And then giving people the front end tools to present it, because users don't really care about what database queries you're running and how efficiently you're doing it, as long as they have access to it instantly. And sometimes that is underappreciated by our users, like, hey, we have billions of games that you click a button and in seconds you get access to your archives over the years, right? Anyway. And then the front end is supported, as many things are, multiple, you know, different versions of JavaScript, basically, you know, CSS and just different ways that we bring that together. But I think you know, the chess board, I love that you say it like that, because if we're talking what is chess online as like a product, the technical aspects of what we do and all the data and the code, the tech stacks and the framework are all about just creating one final product, which is a chess board, right? That is the game. It's a product where people can play and analyze and share. And, you know, we've had multiple iterations, multiple versions of our chess board over the years. And we're actually pretty excited where we're landing right now with an even newer one, still in beta, but, you know, we rewrite and redo and strip out the animation and the code that drives the chessboard all the time, because you live in the world of this even more than I do, right? On the front end of technology evolving and you know, this new JavaScript does it even better than this and blah, 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 right? So you're always making it as fast as you can, as quick as you can, as responsive as you can, but also as fun as you can. We have animations on our boards that you probably know you can activate, like arcade mode that, you know, does lightning when you check someone. So we add all that for people who want that. But the fundamental chess online is actually the same game that's been played since 600 AD. And I say that to a lot of people. It sounds philosophical in general, but it's one of the reasons chess, I think, to kind of build on what you foreshadowed in the beginning of the podcast, Scott, that one of the reasons chess is, you know, it's the success of what we've seen recently is not going away. If anything, it's not like a rocket that you see happening and you know it will come down. It's more like, oh my gosh, this has been a massive amount of lava volcano under the earth, and something just needed to happen to get this out. And it's been around. It's been the same game forever. And so we are different than, you know, a video game where at the very best, it's a simulation of reality. You're not LeBron James in NBA 2K. You're not actually shooting anybody in Call of Duty, and you're not a wizard casting spells. You're literally like, you're not any of those things. You're engaging in fantasy. When you're engaging in chess, you're literally engaging in something that is 100% the same over the board, as we like to say in the industry, as it is online. And that makes it educational. It's one of the reasons it's in the classroom. We have our chesskid.com scholastic site that's growing like nuttiness right now. Most people don't even know because so many people just want chess in the classroom. And chess doesn't have to convince people like Minecraft does in some way to use a Microsoft product that it's educational. And Minecraft is, and it is really great in a lot of ways, right? But it also, there's been a campaign to be like, here's how it's really great. Chess has been sort of accepted forever as like the most cognitively beneficial game for critical thinking and cause and effect, and think about your actions before you do them. And so everything comes down to like the chessboard product, and we're connecting people online with the same product that you can go buy in a store. Not right now, because the Queen's Gambit sold everything out, but you know, chess sets are the same online as they are physically. And that's really cool. Right. And so that's what we're doing. Our tech is all about delivering a chessboard product.
It's great because you do it in a very understated way. Like, I think that, you know, 20 years ago, it would have been a flashy flash widget and it would have done all kinds of weird stuff, but it fits neatly and cleanly within the context of the site. But then if I go and want to share one or embed it on my own site, there's like 50 different, you know, board styles and different piece styles. I can set this thing up to look like the aesthetic of my space as well, if I wanted to embed this in my own blog.
Right.
Yeah.
No, 100% you could. And that allows people to customize and use our board widget on all kinds of sites, which they do. You know, we have other ones too, where you can grab the daily puzzle, which is on our site as a widget, right? For people who want that. Or like you said, it's just allowing people to take the board and share their love of and whatever they accomplished on that board, mm-hmm. right? With anyone who follows them.
So I tried to play a couple of games. I signed up for the trial, the premium trial. You've got a membership, and the membership offers a bunch of really cool stuff like analysis and whatnot. And I noticed it kept telling me that what I was doing was a blunder. Mm. And I love the way that it was
phrasing.
Sorry
about that. It tells me that too.
Is it really? I was like, oh, that was a blunder. And I was like, wah,
wah. Yeah, exactly.
Like, oh, crap. So was it fair to say you were a chess master at 14? Is that correct?
Yeah. So I made the level of national master, chess master at 14. My title now is international master, which is the second highest title you can achieve. It's not, so grandmaster is the top title. International master is the second.
Mm-hmm. Seems like Taekwondo. Like I'm working on my black belt. Right
yeah.
Now.
It's kind of like that.
First Dan, you know, there's still like nine more above that.
We often describe that international master is almost like making it to like, more like Division One or on the bench of an NBA team. We'll say that, right? Okay. And Grandmaster is like you were starting in the NBA for several years. I try to make different sports comparisons because I think sometimes it helps. But the two titles you can earn and never lose are International Master and Grandmaster, because they require a certain amount of rating achievements. You have to reach a threshold. You have to mm-hmm. have performed to a certain level in international events, meaning they could also be in the U.S. They could be overseas, but they have to be events that have people from multiple different countries and federations, right? So it's a process. Anyway, so that's how far as I made it. I was I was a top junior competing, 9-time All-American, and was one of the top players under 21 for a long time. And at a certain point, I started a family pretty young and transitioned into chess business. Mm-hmm. And what was chess business before the internet? It was teaching in schools. You run scholastic enrichment programs, and sometimes you get ECA funding from schools. Other times, you know, parents pay for it. Then mm-hmm. clubs become tournaments on the weekends with kids. And then the more serious kids want to take private lessons and do group lessons. And then, you know, you're making money that way. But at some point we all remember saying the phrase, what's YouTube, right? I mean, we have stories like that. Our kids don't have that. I have a story where someone goes, oh, check out this video. And I go, oh, where can I see it? And they go, oh, it's on YouTube. And I go, what's YouTube, right? Back in the day. And so at some point we transitioned everything into being like, hey, everything I'm doing here needs to be brought online. That's the future, you know?
Mm. Hey, folks, I'm taking this episode to advertise for other podcasts. If you enjoy stories about the people behind the technology that we use, you should check out the Greater Than Code podcast. They focus on the human side of software development with stories of diversity and inclusion, accessibility from people that you don't normally hear from. Search for Greater Than Code in your favorite podcast app or check out greaterthancode.com. So at 14, you're already good. Do you think you were born that way? Because my 14-year-old can't really flush a toilet successfully, you know, and he's a smart enough kid, but the analytics just aren't there. I want to understand, are people born with something special? Is there a thing in chess about the patterns, the looking ahead that is woken up in a certain kind of person? Or can you learn that? Can I become an international master if I tried hard enough?
So it's a tough question in the sense that we can dive into so many things philosophically from just the very subject of talent, right?
Yeah, but I'm just interested in your opinion because, you know, there's about 1,000 roughly active masters, you know, grandmasters out there.
Right.
And there's, you know, long tail is long and there's lots and lots of people who are really great at chess. But why? Some people like in the Queen's Gambit, she looks at the board and she immediately found it familiar and she got it. You remember when you were 14, did you immediately find it familiar and say, "Ooh, this is a Unix machine. I know this."
Right.
That was my thing that I had when I was 14.
It's interesting. I think a little bit of both. What I like to say about chess is that it's pattern recognition at its core, which is ultimately language. Just like, you know, when you look at like a massive list of, you know, of Unix or you know, whatever code stacks you're sort of fluent in, right? And you see patterns almost like you're speed reading the page more than you have to go letter by letter if you watch a young kid trying to sound out the word, you know, sky. Right. And the reason this is important is because what I try to explain to people is obviously I do believe there are some inherent abilities that people are born with. And even if we can't measure that, like if we see somebody who's 6'10 and can jump through the roof, we say, well, maybe he should, you know, play basketball. When it comes to measuring the brain, in theory, maybe there are similar traits that are based on genetics and DNA and based on maybe very early exposure things that fostered and kind of nourished those aptitudes. But we just can't see it. So as humans, we have a hard time measuring it because we measure what we see more tangibly than anything, right? And so I think what I often say when I'm asked this question is I think that, yes, obviously, there must clearly be some people with, you know, different types of intelligence or born in their DNA, the genetics that made them, should they get exposed to chess or code developing or math, should they have gotten lucky enough in their environment to get exposed to those things, they have the natural aptitude or talent to be good at it. And we just, you know, maybe they find it, maybe they didn't find it, right? So I think I clearly had something. My wife often jokes that I kind of downplay this because I always say, I don't think so. I think it's mostly hard work. And she's like, honey, you have like a photographic memory. And I don't even realize I remember numbers super well. I can like hear a phone number or like I quickly glance at the 2FA code and just type it. And she looks at it several times. Just like a funny, it's just silly things. And I'm like, I don't think that's true. But I also think clearly there was something there that I had. And then combine that with the fact that I got exposed to the language. So the reason why language is, you know, something that people speak more fluently when they get it younger is because, you know, the quick, like you may, maybe you don't speak French, but you look at a book of French and you can clearly see there's like a pattern of letters. Like I don't totally get it, but I understand that there's a story being told here, right? Like I can look at like a French book of chess and like see the whole page. So I'm sort of consuming a pattern where you're still focused on like the initial letters of like how to move the piece.
Yes,
right. And that would probably be similar to what you would talk about, right? Like if I said circle, square, circle, what is the next thing I'm going to say?
Square. Like,
based on the information you currently have available to you, that's the best possible guess you can make. But then I say triangle. So now I'm saying circle, square, circle, triangle, circle, square, circle. Now you would guess triangle based
now
on...
I'm like, let me get some paper.
So now you're guessing, like you would guess triangle at that point based on the newer, still limited, but the newer information. And then I say X. Gotcha. So what I'm saying is like, so... just like a mathematician looks at a board and sees something different, maybe you look at a page of code and see how it works. Mm-hmm. Chess is much more applicable or I would say comparable to language than it actually is like math. It's seeing patterns in a language that, you know, that other people don't see. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. So when they're in the car in the movie, in the TV show, Queen's Gambit, and they're playing chess without a board by just calling out coordinates, how realistic is that? Is that a thing you all can do? Because I could have conversations about code without code.
100%. If you want, I'll send you a link to a video that I did a blindfold simul against a bunch of kids in Mississippi. The video is chopped down to only 20 minutes of kind of fun with some music. You don't have to watch the whole 6 hours of the simul. But it's a very
simul means simultaneous.
Simultaneous
so
means
number
yes.
of people at the same time.
So yes, 100%, and exactly because of that is why it's like a language. It's like you and I can talk right now. We don't need to be reminded how to speak English and you know the coordination and the order in which the words make sense. Like we can, you know.
So if you're blindfolded though, and you're holding n number of see how I'm like applying programmer
right.
I don't know how many numbers are. You know, you're holding five boards in your head. How do you know you're like, okay, I got to go and swap out and bring board number five in? And do you see it?
That's a good question. I think I do see it visually in my mind's eye. And that comes from years of like, of playing. And so I just know the position. It also comes with, you attach not necessarily something personal, but you try to remember the game by how you started it or the order in which the moves were played. So for example, like if I start with board one and I say my first move, board two, this, like there is some difficulty to just the overwhelming amount of information in that process. So often I will try to give something unique to the board. In fact, it's funny. What you're saying is I've told people more in the chess world when they say like, how do you do that? I lose the boards. I say, honestly, the hardest part is the beginning when all the games are so similar because they're all in the open and they all start from the same position. Once every game takes on their own individual characters, like I could probably play more than 10. It's actually because once it's unique, like that solves the organizational problem in your head.
Right.
Because it's not a problem of speaking the language.
Yeah,
The board is ultimately just a medium to communicate your move in your head to the other person, right? It's the early organizational part that is actually very tough.
It's interesting. So putting this into an analogy of myself as someone who can't do that, if I were speed dating and I had 10 people in a row and we're going around and we're having a chat with each one of them, when they start out, they're just a bunch of random people. And then they have names and then they have faces and then they have quirks and they have personalities. And by the end of it, I can remember all these different people very, very easily. But they have to develop their personalities before I can remember who they are.
Yeah, that's exactly what I would say is once the game takes on its own personality and idiosyncrasies, right? The things that make it unique. Mm-hmm. So to answer your question, that is a real thing. That's not a parlor trick. It's not made up, and it's a very good thing that chess players do to keep themselves sharp, especially when they're preparing for tournaments.
I feel though that there is a speed bump. You know, it's one of those things like Go where it's like, right, a minute to learn, a lifetime to master. What's the speed bump, do you think? When do people start learning chess and they go from being a beginner to really being intermediate? We've all played computer chess. We've always played the beginner and the amateur, like the basic one, and we get our butts kicked. What do you think people need to do to get over the hump? Is it watching stuff? Is it reading books? How do you go from being...
Honestly, it's playing. It really is. You have to play, and there's only so much vicarious learning that's possible when you're trying to get better. I would maybe argue at anything. I mean, the most astute, students I had, kids that were super intelligent or just for whatever reason more mature than others their age, often it was their ability to focus and learn vicariously. They didn't have to make every mistake themselves to understand not to make the mistake, which is... we can relate that to life. Like no matter how many times you tell your kid the stove is hot, that eventually we've all burned ourselves. And it's almost like your body remembers the next time it starts to get close to that, like, oh, I shouldn't touch that, right? There's vicarious learning, but really you just have to play a lot. And I think that if I was to give one other, or I'll give two, a specific X's and O's is getting a little bit of some opening advice. I actually, I should link you and you can link to the listeners here. This question you just asked was literally a question that my partner and our CEO asked and had me do a series on it, which is still to date by far our most popular piece of content ever. It's called Everything You Need to Know About Chess in 15 Minutes. And it's literally, it's this question. It's like, hey, Danny, your friend comes in and says, dude, just give me that 15 minute lesson so I could beat my brother. They just say, what do I need to do here? Like, and so literally we realized that's such actually a popular thing that it's still... Every month on YouTube, it's getting 100,000 of views. It's one of our, videos that has reached the multi-millions because people Google like how to play chess, right? And like it's so often I would say getting the openings down, understanding to bring your pieces into the middle of the board, not the edge, understanding not to move a piece more than once before they're all developed, understanding to get your king safe. So now I'm getting very specific, but I'm saying we did like a video course on this specifically because it's the question. And then if I was to give the abstract thing that I think you start to see the tipping point where people are maybe doing that, but they're moving to intermediate. It's when the critical thinking takes on the next stage. When we're first learning critical thinking, we are actually assessing the past. And what that means is you're assessing like, why did they go there? Or why did I play that? In theory, it already happened. So your opponent moved and you say, why did they go there? This is actually what we teach kids in the beginning. They move and we teach them to say, hey, your opponent makes a move. Ask yourself, why did he go there? Look at the threats, right? But really the next step is actually, if I move there, what is their next move? And now you're actually anticipating the future. The difference in critical thinking is not just assessing the consequences of what's happened, but actually thinking, all right, so you should be doing why did they go there all the time, but you're actually trying to say, if I go there, like what's their next move? And that is the beginning of like real chess play, basically.
Hmm. I was really impressed when I signed up for the trial on chess.com. The lessons, when I went into the, just the kind of walking you through step by step, and I started scrolling down. I'm like, oh, well, okay, this will be great. I'll take lessons for a couple of weeks. And then I kept scrolling and scrolling and scrolling. And it goes on forever. There's like, you know, you start out at the basics of how to move things, and then it's like rook endgames and pawn structures 101. This stuff gets really advanced. It's almost as if I've learned how to add and subtract. And now it's like, let's talk about derivatives. And mm-hmm. it just goes on.
Right.
Your thing handles all of those. You have like grandmasters can go there and learn, can't they?
Yes. Yeah, they do. And for a second, the way you were describing it, I was feeling like maybe that's a failing by us. If someone feels like they're getting addition, subtraction, and then being asked to do long, you know, derivative, like, you know, algorithms. I mean, that's...
I think it was more about the... I'm going up this mountain and I right. recognize that I'm learning. And it was a very gentle gradient. And it was my fault that I scrolled to the bottom. You know what I mean? It was one of those things. It wasn't like I kind of, you know, you get a math book. You're in chapter 2. Everybody skips to chapter 27 to see what they're going to learn. And then they see the sum, you know, the Latin characters or whatever. And they go, oh, I should not have looked at that.
Right. That's a great way to put it. And that's definitely a slippery slope, right? Because it can be. But it is true. I'll say it this way. Those who are best at chess understand just how insanely complex the game is, right? And and I mean, just think about the beauty of the fact that, you know, we put somebody on the moon, but we have not defined a game of limited information. It's a game of 64 squares with defined movements and coordinates and rules. And when Google's DeepMind launched the AlphaZero project, AlphaZero, from a neural network point of view, the machine learning approach, it did things totally differently in some ways than the previously strongest chess computers ever, and ended up beating Stockfish and Komodos and all the. And so we could get into that a lot. It's actually a very interesting, and I think a topic that probably relates really closely to some of your listeners. I think the machine learning area has always of where our world is headed has always been sort of tied to chess. You know, some of the biggest, most famous chess matches in history are the Kasparov versus Deep Blue, right? The IBM supercomputer in the 90s, right? And we always say that there are still two things that every non-chess person knows. Even the most casual, they know, even if they don't remember the name, this is how you know you've made it. When someone can describe who you are without saying your name. And so they say, who is the American that beat the Russians? The guy who beat the Russians in the 70s. There's the guy, Bobby Fischer, mm-hmm. right? And then the other person I know of is who is the Russian who played the computer, the Russian who played the, like, so those are two huge events that happened. And you know that they're describing Garry Kasparov and Bobby Fischer. And I think that the machine learning aspect of chess is showing that, like maybe code, we don't even know what the ceiling is yet. There is no defined set of like logic that has currently solved the game. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of cool to think about. And even if these neural networks, machine learning, AlphaZero hybrids, because it is open source and people are now building on top of those things all the time, even if they eventually get close to solving it, I don't think the human brain, before we become cyborgs and combine our brains with other, you know, chips, are ever mm-hmm. going to be able to comprehend solving chess.
I'm going to put links in the show notes to that, because you can go to chess.com and at /lessons, there's in fact 24 individual lessons and 143 challenges all about IBM's Deep Blue versus Kasparov. And it walks you step by step, now certainly at the master level, with analysis and conversation about those games. So if there's a famous game, including games that you saw in the Queen's Gambit, I love that the chess community is basically mm-hmm. disassembling the show, mm-hmm. much like I'll watch Star Trek. I just watched Star Trek yesterday. And every once in a while, they'll put some code on the screen and I'll be right. like, oh, it's the year 3000 and we're using C#. And, you know, and I'll go, oh, and I'll chuckle to myself. Oh, I would not. Right. That's not a thing. I assume you all do the same thing when you watch chess on TV.
We've done it forever. And so that's one of the reasons this has been so great, is it's become the new gold standard. Not only did they not get a single thing wrong, which very often the chess you see on screen is like the board is set up wrong and they're moving pieces illegally, these sort of things. And I've done like Google breakdown videos for our YouTube channel where it's kind of, you know, we try to do the fun stuff they do, like Real Hacker breaks down CSI scenes, or Real Spy from, you know, the CIA breaks down spy disguises, right? Like, so mm-hmm. I do the Real Chess Player breaks down stuff. And most of the time it's like, this is ridiculous. So not only did they crush it, but they also paid homage to so many great chess masters and games. And they actually created a storyline of the Beth character based on kind of the chess that she's presented with. And James and I, in our own podcast, recently did kind of a breakdown where like we described how just how well they did that. It's nuts. They Garry Kasparov consulted on it. Bruce Pandolfini did as well. He was Josh Waitzkin's coach, and one of the main characters that the movie Searching for Bobby Fischer was based off of, Ben Kingsley's character. Anyway, they crushed it. They nailed it. And so, not that it, I would argue chess players, beggars can't be choosers, and they should appreciate, as our game is growing, that it's okay. Mm-hmm. If sometimes they get it wrong, it's not that big of a deal if it inspires people to learn. But this has set such a gold standard that it's going to be really hard to, like, just to not be like, hey, they've proved it's possible. And it does create a better, more authentic show for people. They love it. And even you, as like not as serious of a chess player as me, mm-hmm. like you have this appreciation. You're like, man, they crushed it, right? Like you a feel, you know it, right? And I think it's been really cool for us in the chess community to see that.
Yeah, well, I think that if the listeners are excited about The Queen's Gambit, if you enjoyed this great conversation with Danny Rentz, I would be sure to check out your podcast of Coffeehouse Blunders. You just actually put out season 2, episode 1, where you broke down the openings of the Queen's Gambit with our mutual friend, James Montemagno.
Yep.
So I encourage people to check that out. There's so much great content, both on YouTube, on Twitch, and on chess.com. And I also want to encourage folks, again, I don't have any relationship with chess.com, but it's worth pointing out that for basically $30, which is less than a chess board that you can't even find one because they're all sold out, for a year, you can get a gold membership at chess.com. So definitely check that out, all the way up to diamond, no ads, unlimited puzzles. It's really great stuff. Thank you so much, Danny Rentz, for chatting with me.
Thank you, Scott, for having me and for endorsing it authentically. I didn't even know you were going to talk about that, but we really do appreciate that. And it's awesome to know that you've enjoyed your membership. And again, thanks for having me.
Fantastic. This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.